he was tasered for 31 seconds in the chest. And when we got the dash cam footage, what became so obvious was what the officers believed the consequences might be and what the reality of the consequences were. In fact, they had claimed later that they believed he was faking while he was in cardiac arrest in front of them because they were so convinced that what was happening to him was impossible. And ultimately that, you know, became tragic because if he had gotten medical attention immediately, he might have been able to have been resuscitated. And so, you know, it was that disconnect and cops being poorly trained and being, you know, unjustified. And the question was, why were they poorly trained? No, well, they were poorly trained because the one company that manufactures these weapons and sells them controls the training and has a vested interest in them being used. And that's what, you know, made me a bit more sympathetic to officers in general when dealing with these weapons, because they're dealing with a company that, you know, has a total control over the message about what they're capable of.
Nick, as part of this, you took a visit to Taser International. If you could, just describe that day at Taser and what you learned while you were there.
Part of my pitch to them was that I didn't really know what I know now going in. And I said to them that I really just want to understand your point of view. They were also at the same exact time starting to lose lawsuits for the first time. So they had this defensiveness about why they were suddenly under attack. And, you know, they had been controversial for a long time, but it was, again, that losing of lawsuits. The Braidwood inquiry in Canada was this very public inquiry, which was the first sort of government body to say these weapons can kill people under certain circumstances. So that defensiveness caused them, I think, to want to speak from a deep place to me, a 24-year-old at the time, who they thought they would convert. And the problem is that while I didn't know exactly what was happening beneath the surface, it was so clear that they were trying to prop up this image of themselves that was clearly different than the reality, than what was happening. And that lack of self-awareness made me think, okay, what's really happening here? What are they trying to justify? Why are they so staunchly defending themselves? And it all felt very Orwellian. You know, it felt very much like a place trying to justify its own existence. And that, to me, as a filmmaker, you know, you're looking for characters who have high stakes that showed they have high stakes.
How has Taser responded? You said that they had started to lose a few lawsuits and be liable. How have they responded since then?
Well, this is what I think is very important for a new department using Tasers. Taser International, from a very early stage, has done a remarkable job in marketing and rhetoric, convincing departments that they are on their side. In 2009, in response to this Braidwood inquiry in Canada, and in response to finally getting caught with their pants down, I would say, losing some of these lawsuits, they very surreptitiously changed the fine print in their training material to make light of some of these warnings that are very real, the cardiac risks, the acidosis risks, while at the same time sort of talking out of both sides of their mouth. They're basically telling officers in training, well, yeah, we might have to warn you about this thing, but, you know, the reality is the only reason we're doing this is because greedy lawyers want to sue us. And what that effectively did was it put a target on police departments' backs. So now everything we're seeing post-2009, it's very difficult for a department that has an injury or a death to be able to turn to the, you know, to Taser and say, come help us. Because what has effectively happened is Taser slipped out of that liability. And the tally that I've started with a couple other lawyers is just from public records, we're showing over $100 million has been paid out already by departments. And some of that is Taser included, but most of that is departments due to liability from excessive force or death. And that's showing that at the end of the day, when something goes bad, it's going to be the department and the city that is the one holding the bag.
As part of our conversation on this issue, Nick, I spoke with an officer who conducts training for Taser, who trains other officers on how to use the device. I asked him an open-ended question about misconceptions that people had about Tasers, and here's part of what he had to say.
People talk about the number of Taser deaths in the country. People don't understand that so far there has never been a case where the electricity from a Taser has caused somebody's death.
Well, I'm just curious. how you respond to that after all the research that you've done here.
It's not even a scientific debate anymore about whether or not the weapons have killed people. It's not a question of do these weapons kill people, it's a question of how often do they kill people. What are the factors that kill people? I mean, Stanley Harlan's case is as clear-cut as any case there is, and he's not the only one. And that is the danger, is that if you believe that these weapons can't kill people, then you don't believe in science. Because science, even from the company itself, has borne out that they kill people. And that's where semantics and rhetoric and marketing by the company, as you can see, is extremely effective. What I would ask that officer is, if being paid by the company as a trainer has affected his ability to be objective about the research, because he's only getting one message, especially if he's a master instructor, then he's paid by the company to go train other officers. And that's where you see, you know, these ethically dubious scenarios where you have officers directly paid by the company who then go train other officers. So what's the message they're getting in training? If the message is the electricity from the taser has never killed anyone, that is either an intentional lie or completely misleading, completely accidentally misleading maybe, but misleading nonetheless.
How do you think that the use of tasers has changed the way that police do their jobs?
It's very simple when you think about it in context. Only 2% of arrests, best data shows, only 2% of arrests, so roughly 700,000 incidents a year, will use any type of force. That's batons, pepper spray, tasers, guns. And so if you look at that, what Rick and Tom Smith, the brothers who founded Taser International, knew from the very beginning was that in order to justify how expensive tasers are, now I'm not sure exactly what model the CPD is getting, but they run upwards of $1,300. In order to justify, and they've always been expensive, to clarify too, since the very first model, they've always been about as expensive or more expensive than the officer's service revolvers. So in order to justify that expense, what they had to do was convince the officers of total safety, which would allow them to write policies, which would allow these individual departments, which are autonomous, obviously don't have real oversight, to write policies that would encourage their use at lower levels of force. So the disconnect is the public sees these weapons as being used to end violent confrontations or to protect life, basically. And the company's motto, right, is protect truth and protect life. But in practicality, what happens is because they are very effective at low levels of force, the officer's mentality became tase first, essentially, and then ask questions later. It was encouraging them to use force to end any confrontation, not just violent ones, because ultimately what they were seeking was control. And, of course, if they could use these weapons at lower and lower levels of force because they were safe, what the company would end up doing is cornering that 2% of arrests that use force.